across the country, just as it will do when you are forced to release him and admit publicly that you and your department were wrong and trumped up a case against a reporter because you were afraid he might find the answers you could not. Matson seemed to hesitate in responding. Finally, he spoke, looking directly at me, since he now understood that Myron was a solid wall. But he no longer had the hard edge in his words. "I'm telling you for the last time to stay away from this," he said. "Stay away from Lisa Hill, and stay away from the case." "You don't have anything, do you?" I said. I expected Myron's hand to come up to signal me to silence again, but this time, he did nothing. He looked intently at Matson, awaiting a reply. "I have your DNA, buddy boy," Matson said, "and you better hope it comes back clean." "Then that confirms it," I said. "You've got nothing, and you're wasting time trying to intimidate people and make sure nobody finds out." Matson snickered like I was a fool who didn't know what I was talking about. He then reached out and hit Silent Sakai on the arm. "Let's go," he said. Matson turned and led Sakai out. Myron and I watched through the window as they swaggered through the newsroom toward the door. I felt good. I felt supported and protected. It was not a good time to be a journalist. It was the era of fake news and reporters being labeled by those in power as enemies of the people. Newspapers were folding right and left, and some said the industry was in a death spiral. Meanwhile, there was a rise in biased and unchecked reporting and media sites, the line increasingly blurring between impartial and agenda-based journalism. But in the way Myron had handled Matson, I saw a throwback to the days when the media was undaunted, unprejudiced, and therefore could not be intimidated. I suddenly knew for the first time in a long time that I was in the right place. Myron Levin had to raise money and run the website. Those were his priorities, and he didn't get to be a reporter as much as he wanted to be. But when he put on that hat, he was as relentless as any I had ever known. There was a famous story about Myron from his days as a consumer reporter at the Los Angeles Times. This was before he took a buyout, left the paper, and used the money to initially fund Fair Warning. In reporting circles, there was no better feeling than to expose a scoundrel, to write the story that reveals the con man and shuts him down. Most often, the charlatan claims innocence and damage. He sues for millions and then quietly slips out of town to start over somewhere else. The legend about Myron is that he exposed a grifter who was running an earthquake repair con after the Northridge quake in 94. Once outed on the front page of the Times, the grifter claimed innocence and filed a defamation and slander suit seeking $10 million in damages. In the filing documents, the grifter stated that Myron's story had caused him so much humiliation and anguish that the damages went beyond reputation and earnings to his health. He said that Myron's article had caused him bleeding from the rectum. And that was what cemented Myron's legendary status as a reporter. He had written a story that allegedly made a man bleed from the ass. No reporter would ever be able to best that, no matter how many millions they were sued for. "Thanks, Myron," I said. "You had my back."
"Of course," Myron said. "Now go get the story."
I nodded as we watched the two detectives go through the office door.
"And you better watch yourself on this," Myron said. "Those assholes don't like you."
"I know," I replied. Chapter 5. With my editor and publisher's approval, I was officially on the story. And on my very first official move, I got lucky. I went back on Tina Portrero's social media, used her Facebook tagging history to identify her mother, Regina Portrero, and reached out to her through her own Facebook page. I assumed that if Regina reached back from her home in Chicago, we would set up a phone call. Phone calls with the bereaved were safest.
I still have a scar on my face from asking the wrong question of a woman grieving the sudden death of her fiancé. But things can get lost or missed in a phone call. Nuances of conversation, expressions, emotion. But that is where the luck came in. Within an hour of sending my private message, Regina contacted me and said she was in town to make arrangements to take her daughter home. She said she was staying at a hotel called the London West Hollywood and expected to leave Los Angeles the next morning, Tina's body in the cargo hold of the jet. She invited me to come to the hotel to talk about Tina. I couldn't make an invitation like that wait, especially when I knew that Mattson and Sakai might take it upon themselves to warn Regina about me. I told her I would be in the lobby of the hotel in an hour. I told Myron where I was going and headed off in the jeep, taking Coldwater Canyon south over the Santa Monica Mountains and down into Beverly Hills. I then went east on Sunset Boulevard toward the Sunset Strip. The London West Hollywood was located right in the middle of it. Regina Portrero was a small woman in her mid-60s, which indicated she had Tina early in her life. I could see the resemblance most in the same dark brown eyes and hair. She met me in the lobby of the hotel, which was just a half block south of Sunset on San Vicente. It was her daughter's neighborhood. She had lived just a few blocks away. We sat in an alcove that was probably meant for people waiting for their rooms to be ready, but there was no one there at the moment, and we had privacy. I took out my notebook and put it on my thigh so I could write notes and be as inconspicuous about it as possible. "What is your interest in Tina?" she asked. Regina's first question threw me because she had not asked it during the initial communication. Now, she wanted to know what I was doing, and I knew that if I answered it fully and honestly, it would probably end the interview before it got started. "Well, first of all, I'm very sorry for your loss," I said. "I can't imagine what you are going through, and I hate so much to be an intruder. But what the police on this case told me makes it different, and makes what happened to Tina something that the public should possibly know about."
"I don't understand. Are you talking about what happened to her neck?"
"Oh, no." I was mortified that my clumsy answer to her first question had conjured in her mind the horrible manner in which her daughter had been killed. In many ways, I would have preferred a backhand across the face, the diamond of an engagement ring raking across my skin and leaving another scar. I stammered. "What I meant was, the police, they told me that she might have been the victim of cyberstalking. And so far as I know, there's no evidence that the two are connected, but..."
"They didn't tell me that," Regina said.
"They said they didn't have any leads."
"Well, I don't want to speak for them, and maybe they don't want to tell you anything until they're sure. But I understand that she told friends, like Lisa Hill, that she felt she was being stalked. And to be honest, that is what is of interest to me. That is a consumer thing. It's about privacy. And if there is a problem, then that's what I'm going to write about."
"How was she stalked? This is all news to me."
I knew I was in trouble here. I was telling her things she didn't know, so the first thing she was going to do after I left was call Mattson about it. Then Mattson would learn that I was still actively pursuing the case, and Regina would in turn learn that my reporter's interest in Tina and her death was compromised by my having known her briefly, but intimately. This meant that this was the one and only time I would get to talk to Tina's mother. She would be turned against me in the same way Lisa Hill had been. "I don't know exactly how she was stalked," I said. "That is only what the police said. I talked to her friend Lisa, and she said Tina apparently met a man in a bar, but that it felt like he was there waiting for her or something. That it wasn't a random encounter."
"I told her to stay out of the bars," Regina said, "but she couldn't keep away. Even after the arrests and rehab."
It was an incongruous response. I was talking about her daughter being stalked, and she fixated on her daughter's drug and alcohol issues.
I'm not saying one thing had anything to do with the other, I said. I don't think the police know yet either, but I know she had arrests and had been to rehab. Is that what you mean about her going to bars?
She was always going out, meeting strangers,
Regina said.
All the way back to high school.
Her father told her it could end this way. He warned her, but she didn't listen.
She didn't seem to care. She was boy crazy from the start.
Regina seemed to stare off into the distance when she spoke. Boy crazy seemed like an innocent term, but clearly she was seeing a memory of her daughter as a young woman. An unpleasant memory in which there was upset and rancor. Was Tina ever married? I asked.
No, never,
Regina said.
She said she never wanted to be tied down by one man. My husband used to joke that she saved him a bundle by never getting married, but she was our only child, and I always wished I had gotten to plan her wedding. It never happened. She was always looking for something she felt no man she met could provide. What that was, I never knew.
I remember the post I had seen on Tina's social media. I saw on her Instagram that she said she found her sister, I said. A half-sister, but she's not your daughter? Regina's face changed, and I knew I had hit on something bad in her life.
I don't want to talk about that,
Regina said. I'm sorry, did I say something wrong? I asked. What happened?
All these people, they're so interested in that stuff. Where they come from? Are they Swedish? Are they Indian? They don't know what they're playing with. It's like that privacy thing you mentioned. Some secrets are meant to stay secret.
The half-sister was a secret?
Tina sent her DNA in, and then next thing she does is tell us she's got a half-sister out in Naperville. I shouldn't be telling you this.
You can tell me off the record. It will never go into a story, but if it helps me understand your daughter and what she was interested in, it could be important. Do you know why she sent her DNA in for analysis? Was she look...
Who knows? That's what people do, right? It's quick. It's cheap. She had friends that were doing it, finding their heritage.
I had not submitted my DNA to any of the genetic analytics sites, but I knew people who had, and therefore knew generally how it worked. Your DNA went through a genetic data bank that returned matches to other customers of the site, along with a percentage of shared DNA. Higher percentages meant a closer relationship, from distant cousins to direct siblings. She found her half-sister. I saw the photo of them. Naperville. That's near Chicago, right? I needed to keep her talking about something she didn't want to talk about. Easy questions got easy answers and kept the words coming.
Yes,
Regina said.
I grew up there, went to high school there.
She paused and looked at me, and I realized she needed me to tell the story. It was always amazing to me when people opened up. I was a stranger. But they knew I was a reporter, a recorder of history. I'd found many times when reporting tragedies that those left behind wanted to reach out through their grief to talk and set down some sort of record of the lost loved one. Women more than men. They had a sense of duty to the lost one. Sometimes they needed only a little prodding. You had a baby, I said. She nodded, and Tina didn't know. I said.
Nobody knew, she said. It was a girl. I gave her up. I was too young. And then later I met my husband and we started a family. Tina. And then she grew up and sent her DNA into one of those places. And she had done it too, the girl. She knew she was adopted and was looking for connections. They connected through the DNA site. And that's what destroyed our family.
Tina's father didn't know.
I didn't tell him at first, and then it was too late. It was supposed to be my secret. But then the world changes, and your own DNA can unlock everything, and secrets aren't secrets anymore.
I once had an editor named Foley,
who said that sometimes the best question is the one not asked. I waited. I didn't feel I had to ask the next question.
My husband left, Regina said. It wasn't that I'd had the baby. It was that I didn't tell him. He said our marriage was built on a lie. That was 4 months ago. Christina didn't know. Her father and I agreed not to put that guilt on her. She would have blamed herself.
Regina had been holding a clot of tissues in her hands and now used them to dry her eyes and wipe her nose. Tina went back to Chicago to meet her half-sister, I said, hoping to spark more revelations from the broken woman.
Tina was such a sweet girl, Regina said. She wanted to reunite us. She thought it was a good thing. She didn't know what was going on with her father and me. But I told her no, I couldn't see the girl, not now, and she was very upset with me.
She shook her head and continued.
Funny how life is, she said. Everything's good, everything's fine. You think your secrets are safe. Then something comes along, and it all just goes away. Everything changes.
It would only be a detail in the story, but I asked what genetic site Christina had submitted her DNA to.
It was GT23, Regina said. I remember because it only cost $23. So much grief for just $23.
I knew about GT23. It was one of the more recent entries into the DNA testing and analytics business. The upstart company was attempting to take control of the billion-dollar industry by dramatically undercutting the pricing of the competition. It had an advertising campaign based on the promise of DNA analytics accessible to the masses. Its slogan was, DNA you can afford. The 23 in the name stood for the 23 pairs of chromosomes in the human cell, as well as the price of its basic kit. A full DNA and heredity report for $23. Regina started to cry full on then. Her knot of tissues was falling apart. I told her I would get her more and got up. I started looking for a restroom. Something told me that while the emergence of the half-sister in Tina's life was important, this was not the angle of the story that led to the cyberstalking. This was just one spoke in the wheel of Tina's life, although it was one that brought about profound changes to those close to her. But the stalking had to have come from another angle, and I was guessing that was her lifestyle. I found the restroom, pulled open a steel container holding a cardboard box of tissues, and took the whole thing back out to the lobby alcove. Regina was gone. I looked around, and she was nowhere to be seen. I checked the couch where she had been sitting. No purse, no wad of tissue.
Sorry, I had to go to the bathroom.
I turned around and it was her. She returned to the couch. She looked like she had washed her face. I put the box of tissues down next to her and returned to the chair I'd been sitting in to her left. I'm sorry to make you go through all of this, I said. I didn't know when I asked the question that it would bring up this difficult stuff.
No, it's okay, Regina said. It's kind of therapeutic in a way, to talk about it, get it out, you know?
Maybe, I think so. I wanted to move in a different direction now. So, I asked, did Tina ever talk to you about any of the men she dated?
No.
She knew my feelings about that and her lifestyle, Regina said.
Also, what could I say? I met my husband at a blues club in Southside Chicago. I was only 20 years old.
Do you know if she did any online dating, that sort of thing?
I would guess that she did, but I don't know about it.
The police asked me the same thing, and I said that Tina didn't tell me about the specifics of her life here. I knew about the arrests and the rehab because she needed money, but that was all. The one thing I always told her was that I wished she'd come back home and be close. I told her that every time we talked. I nodded. I wrote the lines down.
And now it's too late, she added.
She started to cry again, and I wrote that last line down as well. I should have ended the interview there and not pushed the woman further, but I knew that once she interacted with Mattson again, he would tell her to steer clear of me. It was now or never, and I had to roll with it. "Have you been to her apartment?" I asked. "Not yet," she said. "The police said it's still sealed because it was the crime scene."
I was hoping to get a look inside Tina's home myself.
"Did they say when you could go in and get her things?" "Not yet. I'll have to come back for that. After the funeral, maybe."
"Where exactly was her place?"
"Do you know where the Tower Records used to be?"
"Yes, across from the bookstore."
"She lived right above it, Sunset Place Apartments."
Regina pulled fresh tissues out of the box and dabbed at her eyes.
"Cute place," she said.
I nodded.
"She was beautiful and kind," Regina said. "Why did someone have to kill her?"
She buried her face and her sobs into the tissues. I just watched her. She'd asked a question only a mother could ask, and only the killer could answer. But it was a good line, and I memorized it to write down later. For the moment, I just nodded sympathetically. Chapter 6. I got back to the office by lunchtime, and everyone was in their cubicles eating sandwiches from Art's Deli. Most days, we ordered in food, but no one had thought to text me for my order. That was okay, because at the moment I didn't need food. I was fueled by the momentum of the story. I was in that early stage where I knew I had something, but wasn't sure what it was or what the next step should be. I started by opening up a Word file on my laptop and typing up my handwritten notes from the interview with Regina Portrero. I was halfway through the process when I realized my problem. The next step was to go back to Lisa Hill to ask more questions about Tina and her stalker. But Lisa Hill thought I was not only a scumbag, but a suspect in her friend's murder. I put transcribing my notes aside and checked my phone to see if Hill had gotten around to blocking me on Instagram. She had not, but my guess was this was just an oversight, and she would do so as soon as she checked her followers and was reminded of my previous deception. I spent the next half hour composing a private message to her that I hoped would give me a second chance. "Lisa, I apologize. I should have been upfront with you. But the cops are wrong about me and they know it. They just don't want you talking to a reporter. It would be embarrassing if I got to the real suspect ahead of them. I liked Tina a lot. I wished she had wanted to meet me again. But that's it. Nothing else. I am going to find out who stalked her and may have hurt her. I need your help. Please call me again, so I can explain further and tell you what I know that the cops don't. Thank you." I put my phone number on the end of the message and sent it, hoping for the best, but knowing it was a long shot, and that I couldn't just wait for Lisa Hill to change her mind about me. I next checked the Causes of Death website, where I had posted my request for information on atlanto-occipital dislocation. And this was where my luck and the story changed dramatically. There were already 5 messages waiting for me. The first message had been posted at 7 a.m. L.A. time, but 10 a.m. Florida time, where the posting had come from the Broward County Medical Examiner's Office. A pathologist named Frank Garcia cited an AOD case from the previous year that had been ruled a homicide.
"Have an open homicide, female, 32. Came in last year as single car traffic fatal with COD orthopedic decapitation, AOD, but TA investigators said impact not enough. Scene was staged. TA injuries postmortem. Victim name, Mallory Yates. IO Ray Gonzalez, FLPD.
I could decipher most of the shorthand. COD was cause of death, and TA meant traffic accident, while IO meant investigating officer. And I thought FLPD meant Florida Police Department until I Googled it and came up with Fort Lauderdale Police Department, which was located within Broward County. I copied the message and transferred it to the story file I'd created on my computer. The next message was from Dallas,
and it was similar to the first in that the victim was a woman of similar age, 34-year-old Jamie Flynn, who had died in what appeared to be a single-car accident, with AOD listed as cause of death. This was not classified as a homicide, but as a suspicious death because all of Flynn's toxicity reports came back clean, so there was no clear explanation as to why she drove off a road and down an embankment into a tree. Flynn's death had occurred 10 months earlier, and the case was still open because of the suspicious circumstances. The third message was a follow-up from Frank Garcia at the Broward Medical Examiner's office.
Check with Gonzalez at FLPD. Case still open. No suspects. No leads at this time.
The fourth post on the message board was about another case that had occurred 3 months before. This one came from Brian Schmidt, who was an investigator with the Santa Barbara County Coroner's Office. Charlotte Taggart, 22, YOA, fell from cliff at Hendry's Beach, found DOA next morning. AOD and other injuries, accidental. BAT .09 and fall occurred 0300 in full darkness. I knew that BAT meant blood alcohol toxicity and that the limit for driving in California was .08, indicating Taggart was at least slightly inebriated when she walked to the edge of a cliff in darkness and fell to her death. The fifth message was posted most recently. It was the shortest message, but it froze me. Who is this? It had been posted only 20 minutes earlier by Dr. Adira Larkspur, who I knew was the chief medical examiner of Los Angeles County. It meant I was in danger of discovery. When no one volunteered to identify themselves to their boss, Larkspur might check to see if her office did indeed have a recent AOD case, and this inquiry would undoubtedly lead her to Mattson and Sakai, who would undoubtedly conclude that I had been the one to initially post on the message board. I tried to push thoughts of another visit from the detectives aside and to focus on the information I had in front of me. Three cases of AOD in the last year and a half, with Tina Portrero making a fourth. The victims were women ranging in age from 22 to 44. So far, two of the cases had been ruled homicides, one was suspicious, and one, the most recent before Portrero, was classified as an accident. I did not know enough about human physiology to be sure whether the fact that all four cases involved females was significant. Since men are generally larger and more muscled than women, it was possible that AOD happened more to women because their bodies were more fragile. Or it could be that they are stalked and become the targets of predators more often than men. I knew that I had to add more to the profiles of these four women if I were to make any informed judgment based on the information I had. I decided to work backward and start with the most recent case first. Using basic search engines, I found very little on Charlotte Taggart, other than a paid obituary that had run in the East Bay Times and an accompanying online memorial book where friends and family could sign their names and make comments about the deceased loved one. The obituary said Charlotte Taggart grew up in Berkeley, California, and attended UC Santa Barbara. She was in her senior year when she passed. She was interred at Sunset View Cemetery in Berkeley. She was survived by both parents, two younger brothers, and many close and distant relatives she had discovered in the past year. The end of the last line drew my focus. Charlotte Taggart had discovered new relatives in the last year of her life. That said to me that she most likely discovered these people through a heritage analysis company. My guess was she had submitted her DNA, just as Christina Portrero had done. This connection didn't necessarily mean anything. Millions of people did what these two young women had. It was not uncommon at all, and at this stage, it appeared to be a coincidence. I scanned the comments in the online memorial book and found it to be full of heartfelt but routine messages of love and loss, many written directly to Charlotte, as though she would be reading them from the great hereafter. After entering what I knew about Charlotte Taggart's life and death into the story file, I moved on to the Dallas case, where Jamie Flynn's death was labeled suspicious,
because there was no explanation for her driving down an embankment into a tree. This time, I found a short story about the death in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Jamie Flynn was from a prominent family that ran a well-known boot and saddlery business in Fort Worth. Flynn was a graduate assistant at Southern Methodist University in Dallas while working on a doctorate in psychology. She lived on a horse ranch in Fort Worth owned by her parents and commuted because she liked to be close to her horses. It was her life's goal to open a counseling practice that incorporated riding as therapy. The story contained an interview with Flynn's father, who lamented that his daughter had battled depression and alcoholism before straightening her life out and returning to school. He seemed proud of the fact that she had not had a relapse and that her blood screens in the autopsy were clean. The story also quoted a traffic accident investigator from the Dallas Police Department. Todd Whitney said he wouldn't close the case until he was confident the death of Jamie Flynn was an accident. A young, healthy woman with a lot going for her doesn't just go off the road and down into a ravine and get her neck broken, he said. It may be purely an accident. She could have seen a deer or something and swerved. But there are no skid marks and no animal tracks. I wish I could tell her parents I have the answers, but I don't. Not yet. I noted that there was nothing in the story about whether Jamie Flynn might have driven off the road on purpose in an attempt to disguise a suicide as an accident. It was not an uncommon occurrence. But if it had been considered, it was not publicly reported. There was such a stigma attached to suicide that most newspapers avoided it like the plague. It was only when public figures offed themselves that suicide stories were written. I moved on for the moment from Jamie Flynn. I wanted to keep my momentum. I was certain that I was closing in on something and did not want to be delayed. Chapter 7. The last case I reviewed was the first mentioned on the causes of death message board. It had been posted with a short case summary. The death of 32-year-old Mallory Yates in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, was open and being treated as a homicide because, like the case in Dallas, there were incongruities about the supposed traffic accident that took her life. Histamine levels in some of the wounds to her body suggested that the injuries were post-mortem and the accident was staged. But moving on from the post, I found no funeral notice or news story about the case. A second-tier search brought up a Facebook page that was publicly accessible and had been turned into a memorial page for Yates. There were dozens of messages posted by friends and family in the 16 months since her death. I scrolled through them quickly, picking up bits and pieces of the dead woman's history and updates on her case. I learned that Mallory had grown up in Fort Lauderdale, had attended Catholic schools, and gone to work in her family's boat rental business operating out of a marina called Bahia Mar. She had apparently not attended college after high school and, like Jamie Flynn in Fort Worth, lived alone in a home owned by her father. Her mother was deceased. Several of the Facebook posts were messages of condolence directed to her father in regard to losing both his wife and daughter in a space of 2 years. A message posted 3 weeks after Mallory's death caught my eye and brought my casual scroll through the page to a dead stop. Someone named Ed Yeagers posted a message of sympathy that identified Mallory as his third cousin and lamented that they were just getting acquainted when she was taken away. He said, "I was just getting to know you and wish there was more time. Profoundly sad to find family and then lose family in the same month." That sentiment could have come from the obituary for Charlotte Taggart. Finding family, in this day and age, usually meant DNA. There were heredity analytics companies that used online data to search for family connections, but DNA was the shortcut. I was now convinced that both Charlotte Taggart and Mallory Yates had been searching for connections through DNA heritage analysis. And so had Christina Potrero. The coincidence extended to three of the women and might include all four.
I spent the next 20 minutes running down social media links to relatives and friends of Mallory Yates and Charlotte Taggart. I sent every one of them the same message, asking if their loved one had submitted DNA to an analytics company, and if so, which one. Even before I finished, I got an email response from Ed Yeagers. Met her through GT23. It was only 6 weeks before she died, so never got the chance to meet in person. Seemed like a really good girl. What a shame. My adrenaline hit the floodgates. I had two confirmed cases that shared a rare cause of death and submission of DNA to GT23. I quickly went back to the story about Jamie Flynn in the Fort Worth paper and got the name of her father and the family business he ran, selling boots, belts, and equestrian products like saddles and reins. I Googled the business, got a phone number for the main office, and called it. A woman answered, and I asked for Walter Flynn. "Can I ask what this is regarding?" she asked. "His daughter, Jamie," I said. Nobody likes to cause someone more grief than they already carry. I knew that I would do that with this phone call. But I also knew that if I was right about my instincts, I might eventually be able to lessen that grief with answers. A man picked up the call after a very brief hold.
"Walt Flynn, what can I do for you?"
He had a no-nonsense Texas drawl that I guessed went back generations. In my head, I pictured the Marlboro Man in a white Stetson sitting on a horse, his chiseled features set in a frown. I chose my words carefully, not wanting him to dismiss me or grow angry. "Mr. Flynn, I'm sorry to disturb you. I'm a reporter calling from Los Angeles, and I'm working on a story about several unexplained deaths of women." I waited. The bait had been thrown out. He would either bite or hang up on me.
"And this is about my daughter?" he asked.
"Yes, sir, it could be," I said. I didn't fill the silence that followed. I started to hear a background noise, like running water.
"I'm listening," he said.
"Sir, I don't want to cause you any more grief than you're already going through," I said. "I am so sorry about the loss of your daughter, but can I speak frankly to you?"
"I'm still on the phone and off the record. Isn't that what I say to you?"
"What I mean is, I don't want you to turn around and share this conversation with anyone apart from your wife. Is that okay?"
"It's fine for now."
"Okay, well, then I'll just lay it out for you, sir. I'm looking at... I'm sorry, do we have a bad connection? I hear this back...
It's raining. I stepped outside for privacy. I'll put it on mute while you talk."
The line went silent.
Okay, that's fine," I said.
"So, I'm looking at four deaths of women aged 22 to 44 across the country in the last year and a half, where the cause of death was determined to be atlanto-occipital dislocation, AOD, as they call it. Two of the deaths, one here and one in Florida, have been classified as homicides. One is listed as accidental, but I find it suspicious. And then the fourth, which is your daughter's case, is officially classified as suspicious." Flynn took it off mute, and I heard the rain before he spoke.
"And you're saying these four are somehow linked?"
I could hear the disbelief creeping into his voice. I was going to lose him pretty quickly if I didn't change that.
"I'm not sure," I said. "I'm looking for commonalities in the cases and the women. You could help if I could ask you a few questions. That is why I'm calling."
He didn't respond at first. I thought I heard the low rumble of thunder providing a baseline for the rain. Flynn finally replied.
"Ask your questions."
"Okay. Before her death, had Jamie submitted her DNA to a genetic analytics lab, whether for hereditary or health analysis?" Flynn had muted the call. There was only silence in reply. After a few moments, I wondered if he had disconnected the call. "Mr. Flynn?" The rain came back.
"I'm here. The answer is she was just getting into that sort of stuff. But as far as I know, she had not gotten anything back. She said she wanted to incorporate it into her doctoral program somehow.
She said that she was having everyone in one of her classes at the university do it. How does this connect to her death?
I don't know yet. Do you happen to know what company your daughter submitted DNA to?
Some of the kids in her class, they're scholarship kids. Money is tight. They went with the cheapest one. The one that charges $23 for the test.
GT-23.
That's it. What does all this mean?
I almost didn't hear his question. I could hear my pulse pounding in my ears. I now had a third confirmation. What were the odds that these three women, who suffered the same kind of death, had all sent their DNA to GT-23?
I don't really know what it means yet, Mr. Flynn, I said. I had to guard against Flynn getting as excited over the connection in the cases as I was. I didn't want him running to the Texas Rangers or the FBI with my story.
Do the authorities know about this?
He asked.
There's nothing to know about yet, I said quickly. When and if I have a solid link between the cases, I'll go to them.
What about this DNA stuff you just asked me about? Is that the connection?
I don't know. It's not confirmed yet. I don't have enough to take to the authorities. It's just one of a few things I'm looking at.
I closed my eyes and listened to the rain. I knew it would come to this. Flynn's daughter was dead, and he had no answers, no explanations.
I understand what you're feeling, Mr. Flynn, I said.
But we need to wait until...
How could you understand? He said. Do you have a daughter? Was she taken from you?
A flashback memory hit me. A hand swinging at my face. Me turning to deflect the blow. The diamond raking across my cheek.
You're right, sir. I shouldn't have said that. I have no idea what kind of pain you carry. I just need a little bit more time to get further into this. I promise you, I will stay in touch and keep you informed. If I come up with something solid, you will be the first person I call. After that, we'll go to the police, the FBI, everybody. Can you do that? Can you give me that time?
How long?
I don't know. We can't go to the FBI or anybody if we don't have this nailed down. You don't yell fire unless there's a fire. You know what I mean?
How long?
A week, maybe.
And you'll call me.
I'll call you. That's a promise. We exchanged cell numbers, and he needed to hear my name again because he had missed it the first time. We then disconnected, with Flynn promising to sit tight until he heard from me at the end of a week. My phone rang as soon as I put it back in its cradle. It was a woman named Kinsey Russell. She had been one of the posters in Charlotte Taggart's online memorial book. I had found her on Instagram and sent her a private note.
What kind of story are you doing?
She asked.
To be honest, I'm not quite sure yet, I said.
I know that your friend Charlotte's death was listed as an accident, but there are three other similar deaths of women that are not. I'm writing about those three and just want to check out Charlotte's death to make sure something wasn't missed.
I think it was murder. I've said that from the beginning.
Why do you say that?
Because she wouldn't have gone out to those cliffs at night. And definitely not alone. But the police aren't interested in finding out the truth. An accident looks better for them and the school than a murder.
I had little knowledge of who Kinsey Russell was. She had written one of the messages directly to her dead friend.
How did you know Charlotte?
From school. We had classes together.
So this was like a school party?
Yes, kids from school.
So how do you jump from her disappearing at the party to it being a murder at the cliffs?
Because I know she wouldn't have gone out there by herself. She wouldn't have gone out there at all. She was scared of heights. She always talked about all the bridges they have up there where she was from and being too scared to even drive over the Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate. She almost never went into San Francisco because of the bridges.
I wasn't sure that was convincing enough to declare the death a murder.
Well, I'm going to look into it, I said. I've already started. Can I ask you a few other questions?
Sure, she said. I'll help you any way I can because this isn't right. I know something happened out there.
The obituary that ran in the paper up in Berkeley
said she was survived by her family and several distant relatives she had discovered in the last year. Do you know what that meant, the part about distant relatives? Yes, she did the DNA thing. We both did. Except she was really into it, and was tracing her family back to Ireland and Sweden.
You both did it. Which company did you use?
It's called GT23. It's not as well known as the big ones, but it's cheaper.
There it was. I was 4 for 4. 4 AOD deaths. 4 victims who had turned their DNA over to GT23. There had to be a connection. I asked Kinsey Russell a few follow-up questions, but didn't register their answers. I was moving on. I had momentum. I wanted to get off the phone and get to work. I finally thanked her for her help, said I would stay in touch, and ended the call. I looked up after putting the phone down and saw Myron Levin looking over the half wall of my cubicle. He was holding a mug of coffee with the Fair Warning logo on it. The A in Warning was a red triangle with a lightning bolt through it. I was feeling the power of that bolt right now.
Did you hear all of that?
Some of it. You have something?
Yeah. I got something big, I think.
Let's go to the conference room.
He pointed his cup toward the room. Not yet, I said. I need to make a few more calls. Maybe go see somebody, then I'll be ready to talk.
You're going to like it.
Okay, Myron said.
Ready when you are.
Chapter 8. I pulled up everything I could on GT23 and immersed myself in the business of DNA analytics. The piece that was most informative was a 2019 profile of the company published in Stanford Magazine as GT23 turned 2 years old and had just gone public, making its 5 founders extremely wealthy. It was an offshoot of an older company called Genotype 23, which was founded 2 decades earlier by a group of Stanford University chemistry professors who pooled money to open a secure lab catering to law enforcement agencies too small to fund their own labs to conduct forensic DNA analysis in criminal cases. The first company was initially successful and grew to have more than 50 court-certified technicians working and testifying in criminal cases across the western United States. But DNA became the panacea. It was increasingly being used around the world to solve crimes old and new, as well as to clear those wrongfully accused and convicted. As more and more police departments and law enforcement agencies caught up technologically and opened their own forensic DNA labs or funded joint and regional labs, Genotype 23 faced declining business and revenues and had to lay off staff. As the company declined, a new area of social analytics emerged in the DNA field following the completion of the Human Genome Project. Millions of people began seeking their ancestral and health histories. The founders retooled and opened GT23, a budget DNA analytics firm. There was a catch to the low cost, however. While the large forerunners in the field asked customers to volunteer their DNA anonymously for research, GT23 didn't offer a choice. The low cost of analysis needed to be offset by making the collected samples and data available, still anonymously, to research facilities and biotech firms willing to pay for it. The move was not without controversy, but the whole field was awash in privacy and security concerns. GT23's founders weathered the questions with a basic explanation that submitting DNA to them was in fact volunteering it for research, and they proceeded to market. And the market responded. So much so that little more than a year later, the founders decided to take their company public. The 5 founders rang the bell on the New York Stock Exchange as trading in their company opened, ironically or perhaps coincidentally, at $23 a share. The founders became rich overnight. I next came across a more recent article in Scientific American that carried the headline, "Who is buying GT23's DNA?" The article was a sidebar to a larger story that explored the ethical and privacy concerns in the freewheeling world of DNA analysis. The writer of the article had found a source inside GT23 and obtained a list of universities and biotech research facilities that bought DNA data from the company. These range from labs at Cambridge University in England, to a biologist at MIT, to a small private research lab in Irvine, California. The article said that DNA from GT23 participants, the company did not use the word customers, was being used in studies involving the genetics behind a variety of diseases and ailments, including alcoholism, obesity, insomnia, Parkinson's, asthma, and many others. The variety of studies that the data from GT23 contributed to, and the good that might come from it, not to mention the potential profits to universities, big pharma, and companies producing wellness products, was staggering. The article identified a study at UCLA that dealt with appetite satiation and the genetic roots of obesity. A cosmetic company was using GT23 participants to study aging and skin wrinkling. A pharmaceutical company was researching why some people produce more earwax than others, while the lab in Irvine was studying the connection between genes and risky behaviors such as smoking, use of drugs, sex addiction, and even speeding while driving. All these studies aimed at understanding the causes of human maladies and developing drug and behavioral therapies that would treat or cure them. It all seemed good, and it was all profitable, at least to the founders of GT23. But the main article that ran with the sidebar threw a shadow over all the good news. It reported that regulatory enforcement of the billion-dollar genetic analytics industry fell to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which until recently had taken a complete pass on those responsibilities. The article quoted a recent report from the National Human Genome Research Institute. Until recent years, FDA chose to apply enforcement discretion to the vast majority of genetic tests. FDA can use such discretion when it has the authority to regulate tests, but chooses not to. The article went on to report that the FDA was only now in the process of formulating rules and regulations that would eventually be presented to Congress for adoption. Only then would any kind of enforcement begin. Due to the rapid growth of direct-to-consumer genomic testing and FDA's mounting concern that unregulated tests pose a public health threat, FDA is modifying its approach. To this end, FDA has drafted new guidance to describe how it intends to regulate genetic testing. FDA guidance is different from laws and regulation in that it represents only FDA's current thinking on a topic and is not legally binding for FDA or the parties it regulates. I was stunned. The report concluded that there was virtually no government oversight and regulation in the burgeoning field of genetic analytics. The government was far behind the curve. I printed a copy of the story for Myron to read and then went to GT23's website to look for any acknowledgement that the services the company provided and the security it promised were not backed by government regulation. I found none. But I did stumble across a page that outlined how researchers could go about requesting anonymized data and biological samples and the fields of study the company supported. Cancer, nutrition, social behaviors, risky behaviors, addiction, insomnia, autism, mental disorders, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder. On the website, the recipients of data and biosamples were called collaborators. It was all presented in a cheery, change-the-world-for-the-better pitch that I was sure was crafted to allay any potential participants' concerns about anonymously putting their DNA into the great unknown of genetic analysis and storage. Another section of the website contained a 4-page privacy and informed consent statement that outlined the anonymity guaranteed with the submission of one's DNA in a GT23 home sampling kit. This was the boring fine print, but I read every word of it.
The company promised participants multiple layers of security in the handling of their DNA and required all collaborators to meet the same levels of physical and technical protection of data. No biological sample would be transferred to a collaborator with any participant's identity attached. The consent statement clearly said that the low cost to participants for DNA analytics, matching, and health reporting was underwritten by the collaborating companies and labs that paid for the anonymized data. As such, the participant was agreeing to field requests from collaborators funneled through GT23 to maintain anonymity. The requests could range from additional information on personal habits to surveys in the specific field of study or even additional DNA samples. It was then up to the participant to decide whether to respond. Direct participation with collaborators was not required. After 3 pages of outlining self-imposed security measures and promises, the last page contained the bottom line: "We cannot guarantee that a breach will never happen." It was the lead sentence of the last paragraph, and was followed by a list of worst-case scenarios that were highly unlikely. These ran from collaborator security breaches to the theft or destruction of DNA samples while in transit to labs sponsored by collaborators. There was one line in the disclaimer paragraph I read over and over, trying to understand it. "It may be possible, but unlikely, that a third party could identify you if they are able to combine your genetic data with other information available to them through other means." I copied this off the screen and put it at the top of a notes document. Below it, I typed, "WTF." I now had my first follow-up question, but before I pursued it, I clicked on a tab labeled Law Enforcement on the menu. This page revealed GT23's statement of support and cooperation with the FBI and police agencies in using its genetic data in criminal investigations. This had become a hot-button topic in recent years, as police used genetic analytics providers to help solve cases through linkage of familial DNA. In California, most notably, the alleged Golden State Killer was captured decades after a murder and rape spree when DNA from a rape kit was uploaded on GED Match, and investigators were provided with matches to several relatives of the alleged killer. A family tree was constructed, and soon a suspect was identified and then confirmed through further DNA analysis. Many other lesser-known murders were also solved similarly. GT23 made no bones about cooperating with law enforcement when asked. I was now finished with my review of GT23's website, and I had one question on my notes page. I wasn't sure what I had or what I was doing. I had a connection among the deaths of 4 young women. They were connected by their gender, the cause of their deaths, and their participation in GT23. I assumed that GT23 had millions of participants, so was unsure if this last connection was a valid common denominator. I sat up and looked over the wall of my cubicle. I could only see the top of Myron's head in his cubby. I thought about going to him and saying now was the time to talk, but I quickly dismissed the idea. I didn't like going to my editor, my boss, and saying I didn't know what to do next. An editor wants confidence. He wants to hear a plan that will lead to a story that would draw attention to Fair Warning and what we were doing. I stalled the decision by Googling a contact number for GT23 and calling the corporate office in Palo Alto. I asked for media relations and soon was talking to a media specialist named Mark Bolander. "I work for a consumer news site called Fair Warning, and I'm doing a piece on consumer privacy in the area of DNA analytics," I said. Bolander did not respond at first, but I heard him typing. "Got it," he said finally. "Looking at your website right now. I was not familiar with it." "We usually partner on stories with more recognizable media outlets," I said. "LA Times, Washington Post, NBC, and so on." "Who is your partner on this one?" "No partner at the moment. I'm doing some preliminary work and gathering string, huh?" It was an old newspaper phrase.
It told me Bullender was a former news guy who had crossed to the other side. He was handling media now, rather than being media.
Only a reporter would say that, I said. Where'd you work?
Oh, here and there, Bullender said. My last gig was 12 years at the Merck as a tech reporter, and then I took a buyout, ended up here.
The San Jose Mercury News was a very good newspaper. If Bullender had been a tech reporter in the breadbasket of technology, then I knew I wasn't dealing with a public relations hack. I now had to worry that he would figure out what I was really up to and find a way to block me.
So, what can I do for you in Fair Warning? Bullender asked.
Well, right now, I need some general information about security, I said. I was on the GT23 website, and it says there are multiple layers of security established for handling participant genetic data and material, and I was hoping you could walk me through that.
I wish I could, Jack, but you are asking about proprietary matters that we don't talk about. Suffice it to say, anyone who submits a genetic sample to GT23 can expect the highest level of security in the industry, way beyond government requirements.
It was a stock answer, and I noted that going beyond government requirements when there were no such requirements meant nothing. But I didn't want to jump on Bullender and position myself as an adversary so early in the conversation. Instead, I typed his words into the file because I would need to use them in the story, if a story was published.
Okay, I understand that, I said, but on your website, you clearly say you can't guarantee there will never be a breach. How do you reconcile that with what you just said?
What is on the website is what the lawyers tell us to put on the website, Bullender said, an edge sharpening in his voice. Nothing in life is 100% guaranteed, so we need to make that advisement. But as I said, our safety measures are beyond question, second to none. Do you have another question?
Yes, hold on. I finished typing in his answer. Could you explain what this means? I asked. It's from your website. It may be possible, but unlikely, that a third party could identify you if they are able to combine your genetic data with other information available to them through other means.
It means exactly what it says, Bullender said. It's possible, but unlikely. Again, it's legal speak. We are required to provide it in our consent form.
Do you want to expand on that? For example, what does other information available to them mean?
It could mean a lot of things, but we are not going to go past the disclaimer on that, Jack.
Has there ever been a breach of participant data at GT23?
There was a pause before Bullender answered. Just long enough for me to be suspicious of his answer.
Of course not, Bullender said. If there had been, it would have been reported to the Food and Drug Administration, the agency that regulates the industry. You can check with them, and you will find no report because it has never happened.
Okay, I was typing.
Are you putting this into a story? Bullender asked.
I'm not sure, I said. Like you said, I'm just gathering string. We'll see.
Are you talking to the others? 23andMe? Ancestry?
I will, yes.
Well, I would appreciate it if you would circle back to me if you're going to publish a story. I would like to review my quotes to make sure I'm quoted accurately.
You didn't make that request at the top of the call, Mark. It's not something I usually do.
Well, I didn't know at the top what the call was about. Now I'm concerned about being quoted accurately and in context.
You don't have to worry about that. I've been doing this a long time, and I don't make up quotes or use them out of context.
Then I guess this conversation is over.
Look, Mark, I don't get why you're upset. You were a reporter. You now deal with reporters. You know how it works. You don't lay down rules after the interview. What's upsetting you?
Well, for one, I pulled up your bio and now see who you are.
I told you who I was.
But you didn't mention the books you wrote about those killers.
Those are old, old stories that have nothing to...
Both were about advances in technology being used by bad people. The poet? The scarecrow? Serial killers so bad, they had media names. So, I don't think you called up here to do a reassuring piece on our security. There's something else going on.
He wasn't wrong, but he wasn't right either. I still didn't know what I had, but his evasiveness was only increasing my feeling that there might be something here. "There is nothing going on," I said. "I am truly interested in knowing about the security of the DNA that is submitted to your company, but I will do this for you. If you want me to read back your quotes to you now, I will do that. You will see that I have them down accurately." There was silence, and then Bolander responded in a clipped tone that told me the conversation was over, unless I found a way to keep it going. "So, if we're done here, Jack, I'd like to ask a couple more questions. I was reading about how GT23 has grown so quickly into one of the largest providers of DNA analytics."
"That's true. What's your question?"
"Well, does GT23 still do all of the lab work, or has it gotten so big so fast that it subcontracts lab work?"
I believe there is some contracting out of work to other labs. I know your last question is whether they operate with the same safety and privacy measures, and the answer is yes, absolutely. Same standards right down the line, well beyond government requirements. There is no story here, and I need to go now.
Last question. You mentioned that the company and its contractors go beyond federal regulations and requirements in terms of security, reporting of any privacy breaches, and so on. Are you aware that there aren't any regulations and requirements, and that any reporting on these issues would have to be self-reporting?
Jack, I think you have bad information there. The FDA regulates DNA.
True, it falls under FDA purview, but the FDA has chosen, up until now at least, not to regulate. So when you say that GT23 goes beyond government...
I think what I'm saying is that we're done here, Jack. Have a nice day.
Bolander disconnected, and I put the phone back in its cradle. I made a fist and silently bounced it on the desk like a hammer. My torching of Bolander with his own words aside, I was feeling the groundswell building around me. Bolander had great reason to be upset. Beyond his efforts to protect the reputation of the company that employed him, he had to know that the larger secret of the industry as a whole was in danger of being exposed. Genetic testing was a self-regulating industry with very few, if any, government eyes upon it. And that was a news story. Chapter 9. I printed out all of my notes from the research and interviews. After retrieving the pages from the communal printer, I left the office, passing by Myron while he was on the phone making a pitch to another potential donor. This was a break. I would not have to explain what I was doing or where I was going. I got out the door without hearing my name called. It took me 45 minutes to drive downtown and find parking. I knew I was risking about 2 hours of wasted time by not calling ahead, but I also knew that calling ahead risked that Rachel Walling would be conveniently out of her office when I got there. Her office was in the elegant old Mercantile Bank at 4th and Main. It was on the historic registry, which guaranteed that the front of the structure still looked like a bank. But the once grand interior had been renovated and chopped up into private offices and creative spaces primarily leased by lawyers, lobbyists, and others with business in the nearby Civic Center. Rachel had a two-room office with a secretary. On the door, it said Raw Data Services. Raw, as in Rachel Ann Walling. Her secretary was named Thomas Rivette. He was sitting behind his desk, staring at his computer screen. He handled much of the computer work involved in the background investigations that were the mainstay of the business.
"Hey, Jack," Thomas said. "Didn't expect you today."
"Wasn't expecting it myself," I said.